Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by UC Santa Cruz, chosen by the National Cancer Institute to launch the Cancer Genomics Hub in the quest to decode cancer. More information available at ucsc.edu.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. On the show today, a Southern California school district takes the NRA's advice, arming campus police with military-style assault rifles. Plus, stories of undocumented students come to the stage, and some of the actors came to the U.S. illegally as kids.
I woke up in a lady's house, and I was in a living room, and I was on the ground. All I remember was, like, being really hungry, like, ridiculously hungry.
Also, as San Francisco gears up for Super Bowl 47, the hometown of 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick celebrates the local hero they call the Turlock Tornado.
The Kaepernick cakes and the Kaepernick hot dogs and the Kaepernick hamburger specials. The last time we had this much attention on Turlock was when Sarah Palin came to talk at the university.
It's the California Report. The nation's capital was riveted this week by emotional testimony for and against stronger gun control measures. In Sacramento Wednesday, a group of Republican state lawmakers introduced legislation that would allow school districts to use education funds for training school staff on gun use. And as Chris Richard reports, a school district in the Southern California city of Fontana is already arming its police with semi-automatic rifles.
The weapons are similar to military assault rifles. Officers will keep the guns in safes on campus. School Police Chief Billy Green says he's simply giving his officers what they may need one day.
If I did not take this action now, and if there was a tragic event at one of our school sites, the questions you would be asking me now would likely be along the lines of, why didn't you plan to defend our kids from something like this happening?
Green says ordinary pistols aren't a match for the weapons used in recent shootings. He says the new rifles will allow his officers to fire more accurately from further away, and the bullets will pierce body armor. Some other school districts have quietly purchased similar guns for emergency use. Fontana's policy is unique in that officers will take their Colt Model 6940s to work every day, storing them in safes on campus during their shifts. Chief Billy Green.
A gun in the safe at police headquarters does little good to a school 20 miles away during the event of an active shooter.
But Fontana parent Amanda Rood fears the same weapons that are so readily available to officers could fall into the wrong hands. Her 10-year-old son is scared.
Their learning environment then has to be affected if you're nervous about these things being on your campus. A 10-year-old should not have to worry about getting, you know, shot down.
At dismissal time at Fontana High School, students question the need for more guns. 16-year-old sophomore Aiden Lopez says some of his textbooks are worn out, tagged with gang graffiti and missing pages.
Like, they're good with the guns they have right now, you know, like, my opinion is that we need, like, pencils. We don't have enough pencils. We don't have enough sharpeners, paper.
People who study trends in school safety say that as frightening as events like the Sandy Hook attack are, they need to be understood within a broader context. National Center for Education Statistics figures show on-campus violent crime has fallen steadily since 1993. Buying the guns didn't come before the school board because it was a small expenditure. But school trustee Leticia Garcia worries that the easy availability of overwhelming force could preclude a measured response and spin violence out of control.
We're talking about some, in some cases, kids that make really poor choices that could bring plastic toy weapons to school that look very real, that could possibly get them hurt.
Ron Astor, a professor at the USC School of Social Work and School of Education, questions Fontana officials' focus on an armed intruder. He suggests they take a closer look at the data, like the yearly California School Climate Survey.
If you look at these surveys of what kids are saying, they're kind of the rumbling before the earthquake.
Last year, roughly 6% of Fontana's 7th, 9th, and 11th graders reported bringing a gun to school. More than a quarter said they'd seen another student with a weapon, and 1 in 10 said they'd been threatened. Those survey results match what kids are reporting throughout the state. Cal State psychology professor Stephen Brock, a nationally recognized expert on preparing for school emergencies, says the best way to respond is better communication.
Unless you're going to make schools into a prison, well, you know what? Even if you do make schools into a prison, you're not going to prevent all acts of violence. We need to strike a balance between physical and psychological safety.
USC's Ron Astor favors a community-based policing response.
Talk to any of these police officers, they're going to tell you getting to know people in a relationship way is far more powerful than having another assault weapon.
Fontana School Board President Gus Hawthorne acknowledges the odds are low anybody will attack his kids.
Those are the odds. That's not a guarantee. And I'm committed to keeping those weapons in a place where officers can get to them. If there ever was a tragedy like that, and we hope there never will be, that we would be able to stop it with those firearms.
School trustee Leticia Garcia has called for a conversation about preventing violence, beginning with a public hearing next week on whether to keep the new guns. For the California Report, I'm Chris Richard in Fontana.
Immigration was the other big issue this week in Washington. Congress is in the early stages of figuring out what to do about the 11 million people in the U.S. without documents. About 10% of them came as children. Now, some of their stories are being portrayed this weekend in a new musical called In and Out of Shadows at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
I'm just 14, 14. I haven't even had my quinceañera. I'm just a girl caught between the politics of race y la frontera.
The play is written by Gary Soto, and it's based on interviews with undocumented teenagers living in the Bay Area.
I could get deported like my dad almost did. He got caught driving without a license or
earlier this week, the cast and crew were running through final rehearsals. The actors are members of the Marsh Youth Theater Group.
My name is Adan Ruiz. I'm originally from South Mexico, from Oaxaca. I came to the United States when I was 14 years old.
Like the young immigrants whose lives form the basis of this play, 26-year-old actor Adan Ruiz knows what it's like to live in the shadows.
I went to high school undocumented. I went to college undocumented. I just got my documents like a couple years ago. So it's been a hard process.
Ruiz plays a part based on a real-life teenager who came to California with his uncle through sewers near the Mexican border.
Crossing in these circumstances where it was nasty and disgusting, all smelly and dark for him. So it was very dramatic.
Ruiz says it reminds him of his own life, sneaking into the United States as a kid.
It was really hard. It was just me and my brother. I felt like I was having all the responsibility and very dramatic. I will never forget that, having all of these people around us and then crossing with documents of other kids, American kids pretty much.
One of the other actors is 20-year-old Diane Palaganas. She plays a Filipino mother, a role based partly on her own life. She came to the U.S. legally from the Philippines with her mom, but her legal status will soon become uncertain when she turns 21.
Basically, some parts of the show and some parts of the Filipino family plotline is actually part of my story. Once our immigration status got all screwed up, started with a lawyer who did not file for our change of status to become residents in time.
What about our lawyer?
That worthless bum. We pay all that money.
Okay, we gotta call someone. This ain't right.
Call someone? Like who? Who do we know? We're just little people.
Do you think that...
Yeah, they're gonna try to deport her first and then come and get us.
No, they won't. We'll move. We'll go underground.
No, Felix, we're gonna get loud.
This is writer Gary Soto's second play. The first, titled Novio Boy, was about teenage love. I asked Soto, who's now 60, about the challenges of writing dialogue for teenagers.
I had no problems writing for young people, and I had no problems with writing about a subject that's really, really timely. I think, if anything, it was my weariness, my fear of not representing all racial groups.
Soto, who grew up in the Central Valley and still spends time there, is best known for his poetry, much of it inspired by the lives of working-class Latinos. I asked what he was looking for from the teenager's stories he was given to form the basis for this play.
In looking at the subjects, I really had to think about what are the moments that really would really touch someone.
Some of the actors are themselves either undocumented or were undocumented. They come from families that came here without papers. Was there some risk, either for them or for the young people whose stories they tell?
There may be risk. I mean, we don't think La Migra, like the Border Patrol, would show up. Hey, let's gather the kids and some of the parents in the audience as well, or ICE. But I think it's brave of them, young people who have very little acting experience or zero acting experience, to say, yeah, I think I could play this part.
The stories portrayed include those of teens known as dreamers, trying to get in-state tuition for California universities. Others come from families with mixed immigration status, kids who live in fear their parents or siblings could be deported. The stories resonate with 17-year-old actor Homero Rosas. He came to the U.S. from Mexico over a decade ago, hiding, he says, under a blanket in the back of a car.
I woke up in a lady's house. And I was in a living room, and I was on the ground. All I remember was, like, being really hungry, like, ridiculously hungry. Like, I hadn't eaten in days, sort of hungry.
So what do you think you bring to the role, being in that situation, being an undocumented immigrant?
I bring a lot of, like, maybe emotions into it that aren't maybe not expressed by other actors that haven't been through that situation. So I use what I know, like, my personal experience, to really interpret how he feels and really magnify the importance of this denial that, you know, he can't do certain things that others can.
It's likely In and Out of Shadows will draw an audience of immigrants and their families. I asked writer Gary Soto what he hopes his audience, especially younger members, will take from it.
I think that a lot of young people are not seeing theater, and this may in fact be like one of the first or second plays I've ever seen live, and something live in front of you, and where people, you know, there's music and there's dance and there's some theatrics, so we're going to be throwing candy into the audience, and we have a squirt gun incident. It's not dumbed down theater. It's just very clever theater, and I think they're going to do the audience will be very much involved.
In and Out of Shadows plays now through February 17th at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco. He's been called the Turlock Tornado. But before the run-up to this weekend's Super Bowl, few had even heard of San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick or his hometown. But Kaepernick's meteoric rise in the NFL has put Turlock on the map. And the folks who live in that Central Valley town couldn't be more proud. Reporter Alice Daniel has this postcard.
When I get done here, then we'll have some better...
Ruben Hernandez slowly turns the red vinyl barber's chair as he dries a client's hair in his downtown shop. Coca-Cola signs and autographed celebrity photos line the walls, and there's an antique cash register and a barber pole.
It's got the atmosphere of the barber shop in Andy of Mayberry. You remember Andy, Opie, and Barney, and Floyd's barber shop, where all the guys get together. Even women stop by now, and they just want to be part of the conversation. And I tell everybody we try to solve the world's problems here. So,
but this week, excitement trumps problems. The thrill of having hometown hero Colin Kaepernick play in the Super Bowl.
We were just talking about him right before you came in here.
Anything with Kaepernick's name on it is flying off the shelves in this agricultural town of about 70,000, he says. Hernandez points proudly to a number 7 jersey hanging on the wall that he found at a local flea market.
The amazing thing is that we've seen some of these out at the mall in Modesto going for about $260, and we were able to pick this one up for $60.
He's only met one person who isn't keyed up about Kaepernick. his current customer, James White, who looks like he's just been interrogated. White seems almost sheepish when he admits he didn't even know who Kaepernick was.
Actually, I did not.
Isn't that sad?
Hernandez won't let it go.
How could you not be in tune with what's going on? I mean, Kaepernick is here from Turlock, and everybody's trying to cap in on the Kaepernick phenomenon, you know?
Christina Hacker, the only editor at the Turlock Journal, couldn't agree more.
The last time we had this much attention on Turlock was when Sarah Palin came to talk at the university.
She gets calls every day from her office off Main Street on new Super Bowl promotions from local businesses. The excitement has reached a fever pitch, she says.
The Kaepernick cakes and the Kaepernick hot dogs and the Kaepernick hamburger specials.
Hacker covered Kaepernick as a sports reporter and says he's a nice, down-to-earth guy. Kaepernick excelled in football, baseball, and basketball here at Pittman High. Before that, he played youth football in Turlock as a 9-year-old quarterback. In fourth grade, he wrote a now famous letter for a time capsule project.
His letter said that he wanted to play professional football. He wanted to go to the pros and play for the Niners or the Packers, even if they're not that good.
Heather, how many more Kaepernicks do we have to do for today?
Over at Lisa's Cookie Jar, owner Lisa Fernandez says she can't make enough of her now famous Kaepernick cookies.
Traditional shortbread covered in fondant with a royal icing.
She couldn't find a jersey-shaped cookie cutter, so she's using one in the shape of a baby's onesie.
So we're cutting out the onesie and then cutting off the bottom of it to look like a jersey.
There's a Kaepernick special at Main Street Footers.
You like jalapenos on your Kaepernick, right?
20-year-old Molly Amont says the foot-long hot dog comes with chili, coleslaw, jalapenos, and special sauce. It's unique, spicy, and hot, she says.
Those are a lot of words that people use to describe him and his game, so yeah, yeah, spicy and hot, yeah.
She's worked here for 4 years and says sales have doubled in the last week.
It's been crazy busy, like insanely busy.
Folks here say people are even driving from other places like Reno, where Kaepernick played college football, to watch the game in his hometown.
We'll just go ahead and clean you up. And James, I'm going to ask you that question one more time. Hopefully you're going to give us the right answer. He's saying no.
Back at the barbershop, customer James White is leaving. Ruben Hernandez asks one more time if he'll watch the Super Bowl.
I probably will have to now.
He has a change of plans.
There's a tailgate party in town this weekend, and the mayor has proclaimed Super Bowl Sunday, Colin Kaepernick Day. For the California Report, I'm Alice Daniel in Turlock.
Whether you live in Turlock, Tarzana, Tiburon, or anywhere else, we want to hear what you think of the California Report. Send us an email to calreport@kqed.org or comment on past stories online at californiareport.org. You'll see when you get there that we archive, blog, tweet, and podcast, so you can listen to the California Report when it's convenient for you. Sign up at californiareport.org, and of course, our podcast is available through iTunes, too. Los Angeles in turmoil during the early 1990s is the setting for the last novel by East German author Christa Wolff before she died in 2011. City of Angels, or The Overcoat of Dr. Freud, is being published for the first time in the U.S. It's a loosely autobiographical tale, and the California Report's book critic Oscar Villalone has this review.
City of Angels, or The Overcoat of Dr. Freud, has something going for it that other literary works about Los Angeles fail to take advantage of, namely, the unique satisfaction, akin to enjoying a delicious sweet and sour dish, that comes from combining the iconic scenery and gritty vibe of the country's second-largest city with the sophistication of a novel of ideas. When L.A. serves as a character in a story, it's too often there solely as an example of an approaching apocalypse. And to be sure, Krista Wolf's novel, ostensibly about her time as a fellow of the Getty Center in 1992, has its moments of darkness. Not only do we see the poverty and despair that characterize the city, but the novel's unnamed narrator is steeped in a brooding anxiety, too. She's left an incipient scandal behind her in the now unified Germany, where a government file will soon surface implicating her as a one-time collaborator with the East German secret police. But the burden of that knowledge is evident from the beginning. As Wolf unspools what the narrator calls the running tape recorder of her mind, the book ping-pongs among what we assume are the significant times and places of Wolf's life. At one moment, we're sitting in Santa Monica, taking in the luscious curve of the beach. In another, we're in chaotic Germany, just before its partition between the Soviets and the West. In another scene, we're driving down Sunset Street, Wilshire Boulevard in a red Geo. Then, we're in contemporary Germany, where the narrator is ruining the folly of the recent Gulf War. A world-weary tone of skepticism is firmly set and kept. And then, there are the familiar touches of noir, summoned by descriptions of the troubled narrator watching late-night TV and drinking wine alone in her Santa Monica apartment, or by her routine encounters on the street with the mentally ill and the despondent under sky-blue weather. But what stands out is how Los Angeles serves poignantly, even nobly, as the space in which the narrator tries to come to terms with her past and her beliefs, even with the very nature of love and forgiveness. Los Angeles, if we needed reminding, is a world-class center of culture, and Wolf's novel, which meditates on history and politics and philosophy, takes us to its vibrant communities, notably that of German expats and émigrés. Cast against the cool ominousness and the glamorous beauty of L.A., the witty and learned conversations we witness, and the lives of intellectuals and artists we observe, radiate with a rumpled romance. This is a cosmopolitan Los Angeles we don't see enough. Krista Wolf's last novel, City of Angels, or The Overcoat of Dr. Freud, will leave you hungry for more of it.
Oscar Villalón is the managing editor of the West Coast literary journal Zizova. He reviewed City of Angels, or The Overcoat of Dr. Freud, by the late Krista Wolf. One of the hottest markets for live music equipment in California isn't trendy nightclubs or large outdoor amphitheaters or popular indoor arenas. In fact, it's about as far from all that as you can get, in church. Reporter Susan Vallett stopped by last weekend's NAMM show, the giant music merchant convention in Anaheim, and files this story.
About 1,000 people pack a darkened hotel ballroom. A Christian rock band jams in front of video screens on a brightly lit stage. Some people stand up and raise their hands, swaying with the music. This is House of Worship Night at the NAMM Show, co-hosted by Christian Musician magazine publisher Bruce Adolph.
In any city today that you go to, there's now more bands playing live music on Saturday night and Sunday mornings in churches than there are in any clubs. The DJs have hit the sector and taken away some live music. Karaoke's hurt live music. But a lot of the guys are actually returning to church and playing music.
That's why pastors and worship leaders started to come to the convention that's more known for its rock star sightings. Holland Davis is one of those pastors from a small Calvary church in Orange County. He says churches are now the largest purchasing market of audiovisual equipment in the U.S.
There's over 300,000 churches in America alone. And so just the sheer volume of churches, and they all use audio equipment, microphones, instruments, lighting. And we're in a time where the number of churches that are being started from scratch is phenomenal.
Technology's gotten better. Some church musicians even use iPhones to control audio equipment. And the cost of the technology is more in tune with a house of worship's pocketbook. Davis says as technology's advanced, so have churches.
It used to be that every church you went to had a live pastor. But in, like, for instance, in Southern California, we have, you know, Saddleback Church, which has, I think, 18 campuses with one pastor that's live, and all the rest have video campuses. But they all have live musicians.
Yamaha's Mike Overland, who deals with the company's house of worship market, says it's not so much the technology changing church music, but more that the music is moving along with the times, transitioning to more of a rock feel with drums and electric guitars.
It's not that any one style is better than another, but the way I've always kind of explained it is if you're in Germany, you don't preach in French, so you kind of use the language that people will understand.
David Gudekunst of WorshipTogether.com, a company that distributes new music to churches, says houses of worship aren't just getting in on new audio systems because they sound cool.
It's really easy to look from the outside and just go, oh, these churches are spending a bunch of money on things. And I just think it's important that people know that the churches are, you know, they're trying to support the greater message and get the gospel out there and present it well.
Part of that is getting music leaders and volunteers to understand the ever-changing technology.
You know, something you might want to do in that case, especially pastors, I'm a big fan of this. I had Warren Mike, you know, especially...
A few dozen people sit in on a session at the NAMM show about how to set up microphones in church. Among them, Fred Susoff, who's in charge of audio at a church east of Los Angeles. He sees the modern music at his church as an evangelism tool.
You have to use the entertainment aspect to bring people who don't go to church to get them, in, you know, coming to church. And once you're there, you know, God does the rest.
Why don't you swing down chariot stopper, let me ride. Swing down chariot stopper, let me ride. Oh, rock me, Lord, come and easy.
Christian Musician magazine founder Bruce Adolph points out that in today's high-tech world, people expect high-quality music, whether it's in the movies, on TV, or in church. For the California Report, I'm Susan Vallett in Anaheim.
That's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. You can always find us online at californiareport.org, and you can like us on Facebook, too. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We have additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Rob Spate. Our online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Guy Marzorati and Gina Shalaba. The associate senior producer is Victoria Maleone. The producer is Polly Stryker. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend, and go 49ers! This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation. With nomination information about the 2014 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards, available at www.irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens with prevention at calendow.org. And Chevron, committed to helping California grow by supporting small businesses and investing in education. More information available at chevron.com.